Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Monday, July 14th, 2003. Today's session is Orienting to Life in Israel, the West Bank, and Jerusalem. Session 1 of Roadmaps and Detours, Stories and Images from 5 Years in the Holy Land, presented by Michael and Susan Thomas, THM 2003-01. The session begins with an experiential learning activity, a simulation of the Bethlehem checkpoint. Let's listen in.
Let me say that despite your rather unwelcome entrance, you're most welcome. And you'll hear. If you visit Bethlehem or anywhere in the West Bank, you'll hear continually how welcomed you are. Always, everywhere you go, you will be welcome. I don't know if anyone got a chance to study or look at these maps, the various ways of picturing reality, and I'd like you to get a chance to look at it another time. We'll just leave these up. This shows the various communities in the West Bank. This is a pilgrim's map. You likely would have received this if you were coming on a tour. You would have received a map like this that would have all the holy sites. This is a typical Israeli map. It's interesting in that it doesn't show. You can't really look at it quickly and grasp where the West Bank is, or even if there is a West Bank. Or Gaza is marked. There are a couple of areas that are marked with different colors, but it's very unclear. And the villages, whether it's a Palestinian village or an Israeli settlement, they are notated identically. Whereas on this map right here, this shows the settlements, and then what perhaps most interesting about this map is that it shows the checkpoints, the checkpoints before the Intifada, or the situation as it's called, by Israelis began in September 2000. It shows also the checkpoints that grew after September 2000. And so I invite you to look at it and to plot an imaginary journey. Suppose you are, your daughter, you live in Hebron, and your daughter is marrying a man from Nablus, and you're trying to arrange for the wedding, for the relatives of that man's family, or many, to come to Hebron, which is south of Jerusalem, south of Bethlehem, down here. So you go almost from the northern third of the West Bank down to Hebron. It's if you were to drive without checkpoints on good roads, it wouldn't take you very long, 2 hours or so. But you have to arrange for their transportation, and they have to arrange for the permission to come down for the wedding, and that will be something of an ordeal. But let's imagine that they get permission to come down. It's going to take them, depending upon what the situation is outside, whether there have been any bombings, whether there have been any shootings of Israelis driving on any of these roads in the West Bank. It could, if it's possible, it could take them anywhere between 6 at a very minimum, I mean that's almost impossible, to 18 hours easily to go a relatively short distance. And if you look closely and look for these checkpoints, you can begin to see why. Because at each checkpoint they're going to have to stop. And there could be a long line of cars waiting. And you'll probably notice that if there are any lorries, any trucks, that they could very well be shifting whatever they have in their truck to another truck that will go further to the next checkpoint, and the same thing could happen again. But these maps will be useful to look at because we're going to be talking this week about the roadmap piece and other kinds of maps, other kinds of ways of navigating your way through the situation, through the Intifada, through the West Bank. Do you have a question?
I just had a curiosity question. Is there any meaning to all the advertisements on the Israel
Oh, it's just a, it's a pre-map, and so, so people advertise to pay for printing and insurance.
And it was put out in the year 2000.
And this is, yeah, this is a tourist map, so you can learn what various denominations of Israeli shekels are and so on, what the distances are here. You'll see, in fact, that Nablus, where I said this hypothetical room is from, is called Shechem in Hebrew, and then in parentheses it'll say Nablus. And in fact, it doesn't say Nablus at all. And Janine, no, it does. It does have Nablus in parentheses, and Janine has the Hebrew name below that. So Janine is the Arabic name, and it has the Hebrew names below it. Shechem is the Hebrew name, and then it has the Arabic name below that. Maybe we should say who we are.
Well, I'd like to just process a little bit of that experience coming in here. And it was, I'm sure, well, just tell me what some of the thoughts were that went through your mind as we went through that pretty minimal exercise.
Here,
now, today. Yes?
Well, it made me think that 5 years ago, it would have really felt much more strange to me as an American than it does today. And I grieve every step of this kind of stuff that has entered our society. But to fly here on the plane, I had to have IDs, I had to talk to people, you know, what are you doing, where are you going? And our goddaughter lives in Canada, or is Canadian, and the experience of going to visit her and her family for years was just breezing back and forth, a nod to the person at the border, and now it's many, many minutes, if not hours, waiting in line. And so it didn't feel as strange to me as it would have a few years ago.
Exactly.
And I believe that.
We're experiencing an Israelization of America.
We are.
When I was in Israel, what I remember was the numbers of people, so this seemed, in that sense, unlike what I experienced.
Because it was a small group.
There was that crowd of people, and then the hawkers, they're selling things on the edges, and the long, long lines, and the pressure. And it was so hot and so uncomfortable. It was just,
it really puts me in mind of how much privilege we have, and an entire mindset that I have the right to do things, which I don't think is shared by the rest of the world to a large extent. And so in a sense, I grieve the change as well, but I also kind of welcome it, because I think it puts us into a world community in a more realistic way. I mean, this is what most people encounter. You know,
every one of you did assume you had a right to come in here. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And every one of you was quite cooperative. It was interesting. Nobody really gave very much resistance to this. And maybe that is a post-9/11 sort of expectation now.
But also we knew that eventually
you would get it.
We didn't have the fear that you would have the word.
One of the things that happened after September 11th in Israel was that we heard over and over that now, voicing to us as Americans, to the world at large, now you understand what we have been experiencing. Now you know what terrorism is like. And so for many Israelis, they saw that as a connecting point.
Well, I was just commenting, we went through Checkpoint Charlie about 3 months before the wall came down with a high school group, and then I was very, very uncomfortable, and I had some personal fear and was very guarded to what I said.
And your fear was? related to what? Were you bringing something in?
Bringing something, I want to make sure I didn't do anything wrong.
And not sure what wrong would be.
What wrong would be. And they actually picked out two high school students out of line and took them aside and interrogated them. Really, and went through their luggage and really gave them a bad time for like 45 minutes to an hour.
How did it feel for those of you who went through without with just a glance at your passport and for the rest of you when you saw that happen?
I wonder. Well, I was about ready to go back and tell you that my friend was out there to see if I could get her through, and then I thought, oh, she's going to make me stay out. You know, so you fear for those out there, but you're...
You fear for your own privilege, you might not be able to, right, you might lose your own privilege, right.
But if your husband were kept back in that situation, you would wonder, well, you know, how long will the separation be and what might happen?
Yes.
We've talked a lot about things since September 11th, but I've experienced in 89 of coming back to the United States from Nicaragua, and I was interrogated and my bags were checked and I was pulled aside to another room. I was not a U.S. citizen, so these things are going on, have been going on in this country.
That's right. That's right. U.S. citizens don't understand what foreigners go through when they come into the country.
Well, even it can happen to U.S. citizens. I mean, the Immigration Service doesn't operate under the same set of laws in terms of search and seizure and detention as the rest of the sort of police in the United States. And I've been back and across the borders and seen, since back in the 60s, but they could take you away for 3-4 days and you didn't have a right to return. I mean, that was part of that. It's just now a lot more people are experiencing that kind of intrusion. And you're right, people have a sense of privilege that they have the right to move freely because of the world that we've grown up in, which is quite different from the rest of the world, I think, in terms of.
We were doing the entrance into Bethlehem from Jerusalem. The center of Jerusalem to the center of Bethlehem is about 6 miles. And the cities actually abut one another, more or less. And we were treating you all as internationals coming in, but we want to tell you a couple of stories coming the other direction.
And if we could give you a kind of
Palestinians coming into Jerusalem
before Oslo, before the Oslo process in 1991, there was no checkpoint whatsoever. So often you hear from Palestinians that it's just gotten worse since Oslo. There was no checkpoint at all. You just drove in, drove out. And you find yourself beginning to accept these changes. Now, we didn't come to Israel and Palestine until 1996 for a conference. That was our first visit. So the checkpoints were already in place. But our conference organizer, the Lutheran pastor of the Church of the Redeemer at that time, invited some of us who were at the conference to come on a tour bus, one of these large buses. We were to drive to Bethlehem to pick up Mitri Rothev, who is the Lutheran pastor at the Christmas Lutheran Church. And the reason we were going in a bus to pick him up was that he had no permission to come to Jerusalem. And so the idea was that we would get him on a bus of, say, 30, 40 people, and the Israelis, this is in 96, so it's a relatively calm period. The Israelis would essentially just wear this through, and that's what happened. Another checkpoint, now it just got worse and worse as you would wait long. You could wait long hours to cross if you were driving a car. Until now, there's not very much of a wait because essentially no one is allowed to drive a car. So the only people that are driving cars are people that have special permits or are international. So the wait has diminished. At another checkpoint, between Jerusalem and Ramallah, Ramallah is just north of Jerusalem, you would drive through and there was no checkpoint, and then when the Intifada began, there was a checkpoint. You could still drive through, and it got worse, though. So when you were driving in, say, in commuter traffic, depending upon whether you were going to Jerusalem or going to Ramallah, you might have suddenly, it's a two-lane road. I don't know if any of you have been on that road to Ramallah. It's a two-lane road where you could imagine that maybe you could get a third lane. Often it would be five or six lanes of cars waiting in one direction, usually going from Ramallah to Jerusalem in the evening, and then two lanes coming from Jerusalem, and they would just meet. There would be only a few soldiers at the meeting point, and they would have to handle everybody. Then there would be soldiers off to the sides. I'll show you a few pictures of that, who would be sort of watching what the general situation was like. Calandia is a refugee camp, so abutting this sort of intersection of the oncoming tide would be the refugee camp, and you would have kids out there. They would be throwing rocks at the Israeli soldiers. The Israeli soldiers would be shooting so-called rubber bullets, which are metal bullets encased in a thin rubber sheet. And then you would also have, I think somebody mentioned the commercialization, you would have people that were selling things, tomatoes and whatever else, shoes along the side. Then you would have everyone else who was walking. So you would have old people that would sit on a boulder. There would be boulders along the road so that you couldn't make it 8 lanes or 10 lanes. You would have old women, old men sitting on boulders, catching their breath, hoping to avoid the tear gas. Now, there wasn't tear gas every day. It wasn't like that every day. But it wasn't unusual that kids would start throwing rocks. Our downstairs neighbors, who were Swedish diplomats, were driving through one time, and they noticed a soldier pointing a rifle at their car from about 50 feet. And our friend Magnus got out of the car to go protest. And the soldier said to him, "Don't worry, I wasn't pointing my rifle at you. I was pointing it at the kid hiding behind your car." And so you have this surreal experience. We'll try to show a few pictures of how one artist imagined the surreal quality of Jerusalem. But let's just mention what it would be like at the Bethlehem checkpoint, because that's the one we are most familiar with. We would go through, I think I went through this past year, at least once a week. And so on a day, say it's 7 in the morning, and you're waiting to go into Bethlehem. You're an international, but you have to wait a while. And you watch people, and you're on foot, and you watch people as they are coming out. So perhaps first you meet George Awad, who is the secretary of the Evangelical Lutheran Church of Jordan. And let me say, back up and just say that the ELCA, Evangelical Lutheran Church of America, called us and sent us as missionaries, that was our category, to serve as pastors of the English language congregation of the Lutheran Church of the Redeemer. There's a German language congregation. There was a Danish language congregation, but for the most part, those folks have gone home. And the pastor and his wife are still there, but most of those folks were young men and women working as volunteers, and they've gone home, so to speak, for the interim. And then there's, of course, the Arabic-speaking congregation that we work most closely with. So you meet George Awad, and let's imagine that the soldier that's questioning George about his right to come into Jerusalem is from Ethiopia. He came in the late 1980s, and he speaks Hebrew more or less. He speaks no Arabic, and he tells George to go home, that they're not letting...
An Ethiopian Jew has come to Israel.
Yeah, one of the lost Jews, and who was rescued, in a sense, by the Israelis in these large movements. And anyway, so he's told to go home. And it's a rather dismissive. George has told this story, and I've seen it happen many times on the checkpoint. The soldier will go, there are a lot of arm movements. Go home, go home. And George says, look, you know, this is my home. My family has been here for 800 years. And you're telling me to go home? This is my home. And as he argues his case, perhaps he will succeed. He'll show his Jerusalem card. He'll show a card from the Evangelical Lutheran Church of Jordan stating his position and that he needs to come to Jerusalem every day for his work. He may win or he may lose. And he leaves. And another person will come to take his place. And another often visual image that you see is someone going like this. At first I thought it was an offensive gesture. It just means, just wait a minute. So you see it all the time. And then when a soldier is ready to talk to another person, he'll tell the person when to come. Sometimes the soldiers, and we've seen this, these are not stories that we've read about. These are things that we see. The soldiers will take a coffee break. And that could go on 10, 25 minutes, where you'll see the soldiers off to the side, and no one passes. If you're a young man, you'll be told to go over there and wait. And sometimes you'll wait in the sun a long time after they take your ID, and they will look at it. If you're at what's called a rolling checkpoint, but sometimes this would happen at the Bethlehem checkpoint too, suppose you could drive. You had an Israeli license plate, and you could drive, but you were Palestinian. They might take the keys to your car, and you just sit in that car until they bring the keys back. And they could bring the keys back in half an hour, or 8 hours, or not at all. That would happen more in the West Bank, away from any kind of international observers. Or we'll just take the keys and toss them.
Another person that might be there would be someone who has been trying to get their child who needs kidney dialysis and wants to go to the Vesta Victoria Hospital in Jerusalem to have that done, where they have an excellent unit used. And that parent with the child is at the checkpoint trying to get out of Bethlehem into Jerusalem and simply not allowed to do it.
She'll have a slip in Arabic and Hebrew stating that she has an appointment at the kidney dialysis unit at Augusta Victoria. And she will have called the night before, or someone from Augusta Victoria will have called the district officer in charge of the Bethlehem checkpoint to allow her to go through it. And perhaps the soldier will say, yes, your name is right here, you know, please. Or is it, you don't, there's no name here, and I can't let you in. You don't have a Jerusalem ID. We're going to talk a little bit more about IDs during the week, but again, these are just things that you see every single day. Meanwhile, the young men that are sitting over there are still sitting over there, and the sun is getting hotter, and they will just wait there until the soldiers decide that they can deal with that.
And one of the soldiers that you talk to at the border says, I can't wait until I get out of this. I really hate doing this duty. I'm really ready to go back. You happen to strike up a conversation with him, and he says something like that. And then you...
Why does he hate it? What's the impact of what he's saying?
That he hates being that kind of a border keeper and having to be constantly having to reject people and keep them in...
And diminish another person's humanity.
Okay.
You see that day after day after day.
One of the stories you wanted to tell was that you'll notice that this door is put ajar, although it's not supposed to be. Those of you who were waiting to get in here could have gone around and come in this room where nobody was watching. And this is a very real aspect of security. And Palestinians will be sure to say this, and Israelis may as well, who know what's going on, that in most cases, and in many cases, at least up until this point now, things are tightening even more. But the issue is not security, even though the issue is presented as security. The issue is that people can, they can go around and travel over hills and around, find detours and make their way and eventually get in. So this is not a secure situation when people can still manage to get through, right? But for all these years, that's been the case. And in fact, one of the famous back doors into Bethlehem was through the Ecumenical Center at Tontur, which is, sits on the border of Jerusalem and Bethlehem.
It's Vatican land. Mm-hmm. And one nice story that the rector told us was sometimes the Israelis will try to weld shut the doors, sometimes they'll have barbed wire, sometimes they'll have soldiers. So sometimes 1,000 people a day will go through those doors. There's a door on the Bethlehem side and a door on the Jerusalem side. Often the police, though, will wait on the door by the Jerusalem side to catch anyone coming through. And but one time the rector told us a story. He went back to the door by the on the Bethlehem side. They were trying to weld it shut, and he told them they couldn't do that. And in fact, they were on land that didn't belong to them. And the soldier said, look, this is what our commanding officer has told us to do. These are our orders. And he said, my orders are from the Pope. And this door is to be open. This is Vatican land. But they will come through. And let me just ask, how many of you are over 50 years old? And can you imagine, I mean, this is something also we see often. If you have the women, often they'll be carrying vegetables or something on their head, they'll walk through, usually without too much of a problem. Then you have men. Young men don't try because they'll just get stopped. They do, but the old men will feel more confident about doing it. But they're coming, they're not coming to visit the holy sites in Jerusalem. They're coming to work. They're coming to work in a Israeli home, to paint the house, to do plumbing, to do electrical work, whatever can be done for less money than it would cost to hire an Israeli. So they come through. They'll come through with their toolkits. They'll come through that door that's on the Bethlehem side, and then they walk several hundred yards through Tontur, this beautiful hillside. And then they'll go out the door that leads into Jerusalem. And first of all, they have to be worried about whether there are any police, border police, outside waiting for them. When they ascertain that there's no one out there, they'll come through. But the border police will come swinging around the corner in a jeep. And then you will see these 50-year-old men and older running down other streets trying to get away. And it's one thing to say to see a 20-year-old running from the police. It's another thing to see a 50-year-old man who's just trying to get to work, trying to find a job so that he can come back with some shekels so that he can buy food for his family. And you see that, and after a while, you're sick from sorrow about seeing what people need to do.
So you as an international finally get in, and you feel all of the strange emotions that accompany that. That you were able to go in and the others were not, or you were not hassled and the others were, or you know you can leave this very difficult situation and they can't. And so that's how you enter Bethlehem.
Good question.
Yes.
So the issue is not really security. Is it just long-standing, deep-seated, 5,000-year-old perversity that just is so ingrained?
Well,
and
it's
now it's
original
just being,
sin. I mean,
and now fuel to the fire is being added by current events. Or
I
what
don't
is
think
the
it's
issue?
5,000 years old. I really would argue with that.
What?
Because the country is, I mean, that area of the country has always been plural. I mean, it's been many kinds of people living there. So.
Well, yeah. Okay. Well, what is if it's not security, what's the issue?
The issue is to make life difficult.
For what? For us.
So that people will move away. So Palestinians will leave. Will decide this is too hard to live here. To try to have a job that I can get to try to plan my life, so that my children can get to school, so that I can worship on Sundays and I don't have to be in prison in my home, so that I can get to places that are important to me, so that I can make plans for my life, so that I can build a house that's going to actually hold my growing family, so that they might get an education. And I mean, it's just, so it's every kind of level of, and so that every day I don't have to be humiliated in front of my children.
Leah, let me just say one thing. We have a friend and colleague, an Israeli Jew who grew up in Minnesota, so he talks just like a Minnesotan. And his name is Jeff Halper. He talks about the matrix of control. And this is sort of a point, this is a control point. And you don't need so many, even though there are lots of checkpoints, you don't need so many really to control a large area. And the image that he uses is one of a prison, where you have certain control points, and the inmates essentially have access and freedom of movement.
If you look at a floor plan, it looks like 98% of this belongs to the prisoners. You know, they have control of 98% of it, and the control points only have to be certain area, a small area.
Mm-hmm. And the irony is, the Israelis or the Jews in Israel need the Palestinians for cheap labor.
Well, they're
imported.
I mean, it's a lot like the United States and migrant workers, Hispanics coming in from Mexico.
And now they're realizing that source might dry up. And so they're importing Eastern Europeans, people from the Philippines, from Southeast Asia, and China.
Jews or
no, non-Jews.
So workers. They're making their society more pluralistic than less pluralistic.
Yeah.
They aren't expecting them to stay.
Mm-hmm. What did you say?
They aren't expecting those people to stay.
Well,
they get short term.
Those people don't have a claim on the land.
No,
it's not the same kind of culture.
Yeah, that's a very good point. Let me just say something. We're going to tell lots of stories, but we're going to try to give it a kind of conceptual, structural image for you on Thursday. So tomorrow we'll talk about something different. Then we don't teach on Wednesday. And then on Thursday we'll try to give you an overview of the roadmap and where we're going in terms of that roadmap, so that you can take some of the stories that you hear and see how it integrates with the roadmap, the structure of the roadmap, and how that moves. Let me just say one thing about workers that are brought in. We had a member of the congregation from Canada, Greg, and he was arrested in Hebron. He's a member of the Christian Peacemaker Team. We'll talk later about that group. And he was arrested because he protested that Israeli soldiers had put about 18 Palestinian young men in the sun and just left them there. And he was also told to stay with them, which he was happy to do. But he asked the soldiers why they couldn't move across the alleyway and sit in the shade. And for that he was arrested. And so he was threatened with deportation. And so our congregation and lots of other people, a number of Israeli Jewish peace groups also came to his aid. So he had a Palestinian human rights lawyer. He had Israeli Jewish peace groups. He had our congregation. And then he had lots of people from abroad writing. And so on the day that he was actually going to be deported, we went down to the prison to try to visit him and reassure him of our support. And when we finally got in, we were told he had just been taken to the airport. So we rushed to the airport, which wasn't very far away, and found out where the deportation
area is, and went there, and actually we were helped quite a bit. I was wearing a clerical collar, and I came with friends of his who also work with Christian Peacemaker Team and World Vision, and I introduced them as my deacons in training, and that they needed to see something about prison ministry and come in with me. At this point, the Israeli police were very helpful, and they led us into a room almost exactly this size. It had a TV in it, blaring on some movie or what was being shown, and everyone in that room was black-skinned or brown-skinned. Everyone except for three or four Eastern Europeans and our friend Jeff. Everyone else, was there trying to find work and had been caught either coming into Ben Gurion or had been caught somewhere in Israel and were being deported. And you could have a wonderful ministry, an important ministry, just right there every single day of the year, because they were just waiting and they didn't know how long they would be waiting. If you had money and you could pay for your own deportation, you could go out that night. If you didn't have money, you might be there for quite a while until they find an airline that will transport you for a rate that the Israelis were willing to pay for. Now let's give you, one of the things that we thought we would do is give you a little slice of news each day. This is from a show that was shown on Sky News in Britain, and for those who have satellite receivers. And I don't think anyone has seen that here. And it was a friend of ours. Part of the surreal nature of life there is that I coached a baseball team of boys, and one of the boys' father was a journalist, Andrew Wilson, and we got to know each other, and he produced this series on Roadmap to Peace, and we thought we'd show a little bit each day just to give you a sense. Let me go
ahead. And we'd like you to watch especially for the scenes of the roadblock, and in this case it's a what's called a flying roadblock or what was the other term you had, Michael? Rolling roadblock, where it's just set up that day or overnight and you don't know it's going to be there before.
Sky News is an international affiliate of CNN, isn't it?
No.
Or something like that?
No. It's different.
Okay.
I'm pretty sure it's different.
And, each day he was taking a different area, and
can
so.
Can you see it at all?
Yeah, we have to ramp. Yeah.
Just warming up.
Yeah. And this day he's in Ramallah. Thank you.
Palestinian state, that's where the road to peace should lead. The 1993 Oslo Accord saw the establishment of an autonomous Palestinian authority. It had assumed some of the trappings of an independent sovereign state, including a president in the very familiar shape of Yasser Arafat. But last June, George Bush declared that if Palestinians wanted his support, Arafat would have to go. So, last month, this man, Mahmoud Abbas, or Abu Mazen as he's also known, became Prime Minister, with the support of President Bush, who telephoned him just yesterday. Along with his cabinet, Abbas is supposed to run the Palestinian Authority, but few doubt that Arafat continues to exert tremendous influence. The West Bank city of Ramallah is where both Yasser Arafat and Mahmoud Abbas are based, and Sky's Andrew Wilson is there. He joins us live.
We're in the city centre of Ramallah, and the reason we brought you here is to give you a different sense of what is always seen on the television screens. No barbed wire, no checkpoints, no destroyed compound of Yasser Arafat, just a people trying to get on with their lives and living it as best they can under the military occupation of the Israeli army. Now, Ramallah for the last few weeks has been relatively peaceful. It's still under closure. But we're going to go into a restaurant here to give you an idea about what the aspirations are of the Palestinian people. Yesterday we saw the settlers and we spoke to them about not only their political situation, but how they felt about things. Today is the other side. This is Stone's restaurant. It was built and opened about 4 months before the Intifada started, which might be considered from a business point of view somewhat bad timing. But it shows, thanks, it shows the fact that it's stayed open and still serving people, that it still has an aspiration towards some sort of a free, democratic, tolerant city. You can eat Thai chicken curry here, you can eat burgers, you can order alcohol, and you can drink soft drinks as well. Now, that's not something you'd find in Kuwait or Saudi Arabia or even in Qatar. This shows that within the Palestinian struggle is the desire to build something of a tolerant, modern, even democratic society. Now, we're going to meet some people who represent the future of that society in a minute, but first let's look at the political situation. The first of our reports is about the new Palestinian leadership. In a Ramallah theater, Palestinian dancers tell their people's story, a story of exile and of refugee camps. The keys represent ownership of homes they fled in 1948 when Israel was founded. When the British forces left, the Jews seized control and declared their state. About 1 million Arabs fled their homes for refugee camps in Lebanon and Syria. The roadmap barely mentions this, dealing only with land seized by Israel in another later war, 1967, the West Bank and Gaza, still under occupation. After decades of negotiation and war, the latest potential architect is a new Prime Minister, Mahmoud Abbas, ushered in reluctantly by Yasser Arafat under international pressure.
When it comes to political astuteness and maneuvering and playing political games and checks and balances, nobody is Arafat's equal. I don't think Abu Mazen is the same type of political creature, but at the same time he seems to be indicating that he wants to work in a systematic way. But if President Arafat can pull out all his old tactics and allegiances and so on, if he wants to undermine Abu Mazen, he certainly can.
Between Ramallah and Bir Zeit University, a 10-minute walk has again been turned into an hour-long wait. The Israeli presence is constant and often hostile, targeting terror, they say, but caught in that net are students, doctors, engineers, and farmers. The mobile Israeli checkpoints vanish as quickly as they appear, but the physical and mental impression they leave lasts a lot longer. Abu Mazen's message to his people is that he can improve things more effectively through negotiation than the extremists can with their bombs. It's a tough message to sell. And as far as his people are concerned, the conditions aren't exactly ripe for talking compromise.
But they are crazy people. They just like to live a Palestinian here on this checkpoint because, you know, according to security bosses, there is no use of security here. They just like to torture us.
The Israelis want Yasser Arafat completely out of the picture, but this is impossible. He is still president, and Abu Mazen was his choice.
Believe it or not, immediately after Abu Mazen met with Khalifa in Jericho, he went directly to Arafat to report. You are the leader, you are the legitimacy, you are the address. Tell me what to go from here.
The Palestinian public mostly just need convincing that the Israelis are serious about the roadmap, and only the Israelis can do that. But in their hearts, they long for it all, the way it was before the State of Israel. A pipe dream perhaps, but it gives their neighbors the excuse they need not to trust them. With me is Labib Nasser, thanks for joining us. Hamid Khoury, hello to you as well. And Shireen El Arash. Now I'll start with you, Labib. The roadmap has been presented. Does that, as far as you're concerned, present any kind of change of optimism for the people here?
Well, I mean, I don't think the roadmap offers a just solution or a final solution, but it's a way to maybe move forward to stop this cycle of violence, which is getting worse and worse. So I don't think it's the best solution, but I think we have the opportunity to choose.
A solution coming from outside, is that what you'd like to see? Outsiders coming in to separate the two parties?
I think that someone should interfere from outside, maybe to consider the situation here and to see what's the solution for the both parties.
You're a student, you have to go to the university every day. Is it difficult for you to get to and from the university
every
day?
Yes, it's so difficult. Usually the distance between my house and the university is about 10 minutes. But now it takes me for an hour with a checkpoint and curfews. It's so difficult.
Shereen, what about you? I know you're not quite as optimistic about the roadmap as your friends here.
No, I'm not, because it's, again, another solution that takes Israeli concern and much more important than the Palestinians. And if you read the roadmap, you will find that the biggest demand of Israelis is security, and they have it. Actually, the Palestinians are responsible for the Israeli security, which makes fun, but you can laugh about it if you want. And the Palestinians' main issues are not even mentioned. Jerusalem is not there, right of return is not there. The Palestinian state that's suggested is vaguely suggested. What is the temporary order?
I see you all there, Lavi. Do you think that's right, that the thorny issues yet again are being left for later?
Yes, yeah. I think that was the problem with the Oslo, is that you left this final status that nobody wants to talk about. If you postpone it again, I'm afraid there won't be any land left to negotiate over with Israel's settlement policy still escalating and building it.
The state of the potential state of the Palestinian state, that's where you find me now, at the headquarters of Yasser Arafat in Ramallah. The headquarters completely destroyed. The president is a few yards away from me up there in his bed quarters. And much else of the Mukatta now has been destroyed.
Those are all cars that have been blown over by tanks.
It's been destroyed partly by Israeli military action. Now, the modern leg of this tragedy, this Palestinian tragedy, started when the British were still here. 56 years ago, the British were in charge of Greater Palestine. Everything from the Jordan River all the way to the Mediterranean. Jews and Arabs lived alongside each other. The Jews fought with the Arabs, and the Arabs fought with the Jews, but both of them fought with the British, and they threw in the towel. And at that point, 55 years ago, the Israelis went to war with the Arabs, and it ended with the Israeli flag being raised over 80% of what was then Greater Palestine. Arabs living on that territory fled abroad. The rest were here in the West Bank. Palestinians now under Jordanian occupation. 10 years later, another war, and the Israelis took the rest. It wasn't exactly the plan, but young commanders like Ariel Sharon at that time were hard to contain. That meant now the 20% of the West Bank left to offer Greater Palestine was now under Israeli occupation as well. The story since then has been one of negotiation. Israel saying it's ready to pull back, but still settling people on the Palestinian land, and the Palestinians saying they want to fight for their freedom. The question is, if the international community does want a Palestinian state, then why haven't they got one after all these years of negotiation? And if they don't, why isn't the Israeli flag flying over Yasser Arafat's compound by now?
Jenin in the West Bank has become synonymous with Palestinian militancy and Israeli incursions. It's been...
So we're at... at 11:45, and... obviously, we have once again come with, we got through about a third of what we hoped to get through today. So that's the problem, is that there's so much and we want to tell it all, and sometimes we do that in more coherent ways than others. And so I hope that we'll be able to get at least some of those stories out during this week and some of that experience out. It is a kind of overwhelming experience. Forbear with us.
Yeah. Let me just conclude by saying that lots of times when Europeans, after having lived in the West Bank and Jerusalem and Israel for a time, imagine their route home. And they want to think of a route that has some quality of time to it, because they can't imagine leaving Ben Gurion Airport outside of Tel Aviv early in the morning and having tea in Gothenburg, Sweden that afternoon. That they can't bring what you saw, some of the scenes on this video. They can't be back in Sweden that same day. They need time. And so one of our fun fantasies was to imagine how we would leave. And we would talk with people. We would go through Lebanon to Syria to Turkey and so on. Or we would take a boat from Haifa to Cyprus, and then we would charter a sailboat to Greece and then, and so on. And we imagine it. But for most Americans, that's not really feasible.
mostly we have to leave from Ben Gurion and we have to fly the least expensive way, as you would expect, to the United States. And so it's not possible. And so I was talking with my Swedish colleague, the chaplain of the Swedish Theological Institute in Jerusalem, Anders Blomqvist, and we were talking about how they would go home and how we would go home. And then he turned to me and said, well, Michael, you know, you have to fly. And so what you're going to have is a jet-lagged heart. And I think that's, you know, there are no little pills that you can take. You can't get out in the sunlight. That it helps to come to Holden, though, to breathe in the clear air and to have time to think and most of all time to talk with you. So Susan and I are available during the time that we are here to talk, and we would like to hear some of your stories as well. How many have been to Israel or the West Bank? Okay, so a few of you have been there, and we can try to talk about our shared experiences and how you imagine the situation.
When did you get back?
Well, I got back at the very end of June.
Are you going to discuss the so-called roadmap?
Yeah, on Thursday.
On Thursday with us?
We'll talk about the goals and the processes. And
because I feel a need to have some clarification. I've heard what seems a very superficial kinds of reports from it. Thank you. On Thursday. Okay. Go in peace.